Welcome to Gold Star Classroom, the podcast where our panelists go back to school. We'll grade them on their answers to a variety of general knowledge and trivia questions. They don't know what we're going to ask, and we don't know what they're going to say. The student with the highest grade at the end of the class will win the coveted classroom prize, the Golden Banana. I'm your host and headmaster, Professor Jerry Jaffe. Welcome to today's episode of Gold Star Classroom, being recorded live at Toth's Place, your local watering hole in Mentor, Ohio. I'd like to take this opportunity to introduce today's students. On my right, from Kent, Ohio, Sean Sullivan.
Hey.
Hey, Sean. Thanks for coming to class today.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. And on my left, the world-famous Dr. Andy Meredith.
Thank you for having me.
Oh,
very glad to be here.
We're glad to have you here, Dr. Meredith. And sitting directly across from me is educator Eddie Warner.
Welcome. Thank you. Great to be here.
I, of course, am your host and professor,
Welcome
Dr. Jerry Jaffe. Don't interrupt the teacher, Andy. Minus 5 points. Dr. Jerry Jaffe.
A real doctor.
For the purposes of this joke, I treat you as an intellectual equal.
That's the funniest thing you've ever said.
quite probably. During today's class, I'm going to ask you students a variety of questions from across the fountain of human knowledge, and we'll see what you've learned to drink over your education so far.
I'm ready to get wet, Jerry.
Are you ready to get wet? Well, you've come to the right place, Dr. Meredith. We're going to start in the area of human biology and anatomy. And it's a little bit of a philosophical question. What are you? But let me be more specific. How many cells are in your body?
Can this be a Price is Right closest without going over?
Well, what would be your
one
closest
cell,
without going
one
over?
Cell.
Sean is a single cell entity.
700 trillion.
Sean's answer is one. Dr. Meredith's answer is 700 trillion. Eddie, would you like to posit a guess?
Yes. I know personally I have at least 700 million sperm cells, so I know it has to be more than Andy's answer. So I'll guess.
I said trillion with a T.
Trillion. I'll guess quadrillion.
Okay. A trillion has 12 zeros, by the way. I don't know how many zeros are in quadrillion. So
four. Zero and one.
Yes.
I was thinking 16.
I don't think there's any zeros in quadrillion. There's a Q, a U, an A, a D. Mm-hmm. I don't know of any zeros.
Whatever one is followed by 16 zeros will be my final answer.
Now, it's interesting that Eddie brings up himself because, of course, cells are so small and every body, literal human body, is different. So scientists who try to estimate this can only estimate. There's not really a precise answer to this question.
So it's, you know,
adults, children, fat, skinny, men, women, there's all sorts of health factors. But if we were going to use Dr. Meredith's suggestion of closest without going over, and your answer was 700 trillion, and Eddie's was a quadrillion, and Sean's was one, Sean. I have to award a gold star to Sean.
Yeah. I won the TV.
There's no TV involved.
Spin the wheel.
We could arrange a brown nose, if that helps in any way. The usual estimates, and you will see different answers, but the estimate range is 50 to 100 trillion cells. So that'd be 14 zeros if you say 100 trillion.
I could have been better than you.
But now we can get even more esoteric. How many atoms are there inside of you? And if to give you a hint, an atom is a lot smaller than a cell.
Oh.
So the number is a lot bigger.
I thought you meant like atoms, like dudes. Like how many dudes?
How many atoms or Eves?
Yeah.
How many holes?
Sounds like a Jeffrey Dahmer question now.
Quite possibly.
Three atoms and one Steve and a little bit
another
of...
Another world famous Ohioan. I'm right up there with Jeffrey Dahmer, apparently. That's nice. I'm going to go with 700 trillion. I might get closer.
Any thoughts? 700 trillion?
We're not doing prices right. We're just doing whoever's closest.
Eddie, you've raised your hand. What would be your estimate for how many atoms are in your body?
I would like Sean to go next, and my answer will be one more than Sean's final answer.
I said we're not doing Crisis Radio.
I decide how this is graded.
I will go into exponential notation. Okay. I'll go like 10 to the 70th power.
I was told there would be no math.
What were the bids, Jerry?
The bids so far are 10 to the 70th power and 700 trillion.
700 trillion and one.
If we go with the Price is Right model of estimating numbers, Sean is again correct. Your number, Andy, Dr. Meredith being too small, and your number, Eddie, being too large.
I'm more impressed that you know how much 10 to the 70th is.
Well, it's a 1 with 70 zeros after it.
That's what that means?
Yes, that is what that means.
Like someone learned something on this show.
As the genie said about Aladdin, he can be taught. Again, we're talking about estimating very large numbers. Each cell in your body, each individual cell, has about 100 trillion atoms in it. So it's whatever 100 trillion times 100 trillion is.
I feel really insignificant right now.
You're welcome. Would it make you feel better if I were to ask you this question? Going back to cells, so there's approximately 50 to 100 trillion cells, 50 trillion to 100 trillion cells in the typical human body, but not all of those cells are human cells. Each body is itself a microenvironment covered with microorganisms, bacteria, viruses, and other microbes and germs. Mm-hmm. So of that 50 trillion, 100 trillion cells, how many of them are human? How many of them are the non-human cells? We could put it as a percentage, like 10%, 50%, 99%.
I would go 60-40 human.
60% human.
Okay.
All right. Any thought how much of your body cells are actually?
What kind of educator are
I'll
you?
Say,
because we've had a lot of science questions.
I'll say 20% alien, and then the rest human.
So you're going, Dr. Meredith, 60% human?
Yes.
Eddie, 80% human? What would be your guesstimate, Sean?
81%.
61%.
Well, since you all phrased your answer in terms of the human cells, the estimate of the amount of human cells in your 100 trillion cells is about 10%.
Wow. We have to rebid.
As you all went over. So about 90% of
they
the
went
cells.
Over, I should get.
You were the closest wrong answer.
There's an and then we all get to guess again.
Jerry, you're creeping me out. 90% of us is bacteria and
viruses
viral.
And other microorganisms. The most common is a primitive cell called an archaea cell or archaea cell. An archaea cell is considered primitive because it has no nucleus. So back billions of years ago, that was an early cell form. And that's a large percentage of the cells. I don't have the exact number on that, but maybe a third or a half of your microbes are these primitive cells. Of course, some of these microorganisms are kind of famous. For example, the bacteria in your stomach helps you digest. You wouldn't be able to digest food without the bacteria. So there's a fancy word for that when two organisms coexist and keep each other alive. 5 points for Dr. Meredith. Symbiotic.
It regained you because you're negative.
I'm back at zero.
So this is an area of modern medicine, is what kind of symbiotic relationship do all of these other microorganisms have in our health? And doctors study, medical researchers study, does it affect our mental health, depression, our diet, our immune system, and things like that. There is a person, and this is related to our talk of micro cell biology, who is involved, and I do mean involved, so I don't mean like a historian who's written about it. I mean someone who's like in the lab participating, but whose contribution to 20th century, 21st century science is probably singularly great. They are involved in the study of cancer, involved in the study of the space program and gravity's effects on the body, involved in the polio vaccine, involved in studies of mental health, depression, and even science education. And the list is actually much longer than that. I just listed 4 or 5 of the most famous things this person's involved in. It's kind of shot in the dark, but anyone want to hazard a guess? Have you ever heard of this person?
Or does it sound like somebody you know? But her cells keep replicating, right?
Andy Meredith just got a gold star.
I do not remember her name, though.
Bob Barker.
It's not Bob Barker.
It's not Bob Barker.
Anne Frank.
It's not Anne Frank. There is one person who in the 50s had a very serious case of cancer, and doctors cultured her cancer cells.
Oh, and she's an African-American
woman.
Autobiography out about her now, currently, one of my friends read, and they're trying to sue for, like, all the benefits and things.
The family's been trying to sue since she died.
Yeah, the family.
Well, what happened is when they took the samples without really informing her or her family, that by itself is still, even though that was in the 50s, somewhat common today. If you have a surgery or even things like umbilical cord blood, if you don't claim that stuff for yourself, the doctor doing the procedure can just take it for their research purposes.
How do you claim it? Like, do you just
tell
like,
them
dibs?
You want it, basically. If you get a wisdom tooth removed, you're like, I want that.
Well, Tooth Fairy, obviously.
The Tooth Fairy, there's less paperwork with the Tooth Fairy, but when you have a major procedure, there's a lot of paperwork that you sign. And so if you care about this issue, you've got to be careful what you sign.
I just remembered her name, Dr. Jaffe. I believe it's Oprah Winfrey, because she's been replicating for years now.
Rosa Parks.
No and no.
Beyonce.
But you've now listed all the African-American women you know by name, haven't you?
Halle Berry.
Ooh, nice one. But minus 5 points for distracting your teacher, because now I'm thinking about Halle Berry. This woman's name is Henrietta Lacks.
Yes.
Okay. And her family did not find out that her cells were turned into a lab in John Hopkins University Hospital. And usually human cells die very quickly, even in cultures. But hers kept replicating, and which was very unusual at the time.
And still replicating.
And are still replicating to this day.
Are they making like a new person? Or like what are they doing?
Well, cells reproduce through mitosis, so they separate and make two cells that are more or less identical.
Yeah.
And usually human cells that are isolated in like a petri dish die in a few days. But for whatever reason, which they still don't know 50, 60 years later, the exact mechanism, hers continue to reproduce. The mitosis doesn't stop. They do feed nutrients, and they do have equipment that's involved.
Yeah.
But still, the fact that her cells continue to reproduce... There is over 20 tons of her cells in existence right now.
Wow.
If we weighed it, that'd be about 40,000 pounds. And there are over 11...
What have you done?
Over 11,000 patents have been derived from her cells. By a cruel irony, the doctor who cultivated and found that he could reproduce her cells, who was Dr. Guy, George Otto Guy, John Hopkins... announced his discovery on television on the very same day that Henrietta Lacks died. And he didn't know who the patient was because he just had cells in his lab, and she didn't know that this was happening. So it was just a sorry coincidence that she died the same day the announcement of, I finally got cells to like sustain and reproduce in my laboratory.
Did she know about it before she died? Or?
No. She herself knew nothing about it. And to... slightly correct something Dr. Meredith said. Her family only found out about it in the 70s because, like, 20 years later, some scientists finally thought, we need to get cells from other family members.
Yeah.
And so they went back to her children and descendants.
That takes time.
It seems so obvious when you say it now. If there's something special about her genetics, maybe all of her children have that too.
Yeah.
So what happened to her children, I think she had five children, is suddenly like scientists showed up at their door wanting to collect blood and tissue samples, and they didn't know why. And so as they were explained why, they were suddenly introduced in this whole world of science and medical research in her mother's cells. And then one of the consequences, as Dr. Meredith said, is the lawsuits. Like they're trying to get those 11,000 patents derived from their mother's cells.
There's money to be had for the...
But under the legal system, especially of the 50s, what the hospital and those original researchers like Dr. Guy did was like legal proper protocol. So from one ethical point of view, or not say ethical, one legal point of view, they owe the family nothing.
Yeah.
So
the question would be, now, like with 2020 hindsight, is there some legacy that the family is owed?
Can get like a plaque or something.
Yeah, like what they're owed.
There are a couple. There are some plaques and some recognition.
A gold star.
There should at least be a gold star.
Jerry, is there a card for that?
No, but I will say there's one last piece of general trivia that goes with this topic. And that is that the cell line, they say the cell line has a name.
Lax line.
No.
Plinko.
No.
Bob.
No. Nor is it Eddie.
That was my next guess.
I know. Eddie is always somebody's next guess. Nobody ever guesses Eddie first. Hela.
Story.
Her first two letters, Henrietta Lax, H-E-L-A, Hela. And so there's high school and college biology students right now doing experiments with petri dishes or test tubes labeled Hela, who don't know that that is Henrietta Lacks' legacy.
Wow, that's crazy.
Yes.
Adding to a list of things high school kids don't know.
An ever-expanding list. They say at this point information doubles every couple of days, and the amount of information known by high school students doubles every couple of days. All right, well, that ends your quiz on human cell biology.
Did we usually clap after every test? Or?
I don't know. Just be spontaneous, I guess. You may not want to clap after you hear your provisionary grades, which Dr. Meredith does have the highest F in class. But if anybody would like to have a grade higher than F, you'll need to do better on this next topic. And for the next few minutes, we'll turn our attention to the world of the theater. Who knows?
My strength.
Oh, Dr. Meredith is ready to shine. We can see your cells glowing from here.
I'm dividing for you, Jerry.
That's why I refer to Andy as my ptosis. It has been argued that the single most important history in the long history of the human species was?
Printing press.
Printing press is on the list. Eddie, single most important invention in human history.
I will say the inflatable doll.
The inflatable doll?
Soap.
Soap is a good one. Two of those three answers are probably on the list. I'm not sure the year that the inflatable doll was invented, but I will say you can find dildos through all of human history. So sexual toys and sexual aids.
Fat girls have needed love throughout the annals of time.
However, and of course this is a debatable point, but the right answer is agriculture.
My VCD class begs to differ. It's a printing press.
Jerry, if it's not too late, I would like to change my answer from inflatables to agriculture.
It is too late. The printing press is a good answer, and it might be the answer if we phrase the question the most important history invention in sort of modern history or in this sort of civilization, something like that. But in order to have civilization, you must have agriculture first.
Yeah.
Before agriculture, humans are hunter-gatherers in small, familiar bands.
But then they have books on agriculture.
That's right.
So.
And they can use a movable printing press to make books about agriculture.
They did the agriculture before books.
But if people got better after they had books.
Interestingly, you mentioned before, the word before. Approximately, again, there's not a zero exact answer to this, but we have a good estimate. When was agriculture, quote-unquote, invented?
1776, America.
Before 1776, there is no history.
I'll say 10,000 BC.
We have two very different
it
answers.
It sounded like you were talking about, like, it was around the printing press. Printing press, I think, was 1495.
1400s, I don't have an exact number in front of me, so we can fact check that
viewers
later.
Viewers at home can look it up.
Yes.
Listeners.
Please do.
Viewers at your screen. So I'm going to go 1494.
The interesting thing, there's something interesting about your answer, Sean. I mean, it is wrong. But the interesting thing about your answer is that sometimes people conversationally will use the word farming. But farming is not precisely the same thing as agriculture, because farming is a more of a business concept. farming is agriculture turned into the feudal model in which the sort of plantations and farms in the sense that we think of them.
It's Kansas.
Happen. More like Kansas, for example. But the early invention of domesticating animals and plants for human consumption goes back about 10,000 years. So Eddie was close in the estimate there. For which you can have a gold star for a change.
Touch me.
Do you know where agriculture was first developed?
Egypt.
We have a vote on Egypt.
Mesopotamia.
We have a vote for Mesopotamia.
Kansas.
We have a vote for Kansas. The Kansas vote is not as crazy as you might say, although, again, it's not technically correct.
Story of
Indians,
right? They tend to say...
Can I say Africa?
You can say any word that you're capable of saying. I'm not saying how many points you will get or lose for saying Africa. Archaeologists and anthropologists identify three areas of the globe where agriculture sort of developed independently. The one that was not mentioned at all is China.
Because why?
The one that is most usually mentioned is referred to as the Fertile Crescent, which is basically Egypt over through Persia, like that area. And then the third region is sort of Central North America, probably closer to Mexico than Kansas, but North America, Central North America. Those three areas about 10,000 years ago independently saw the development of the domestication of fauna, flora, animals, things you can eat.
Cats, pyramids.
Until you have agriculture, you don't have food surpluses. Hunter-gatherers were always hungry, or at least always looking for food. They had no mechanism to store grain or to keep animals for food. So when you have food surpluses, basically then you can start having civilization. You can have towns, villages, and writing. Writing is there's basically no writing before agriculture because writing was invented to keep track of food surpluses and so forth.
So I'm right.
So in a way you are ish, yes. You have a kind of rightness about you.
Cool.
Yes, in a certain light.
I got like a bronze star.
I did, it could be a silver star. It could be a silver star.
First loser.
Pretty sure you were already taken out.
I did jot down a couple of the other famous human developments just to see if you can estimate when they were developed. You might think of the wheel.
40,000 BC.
40,000 BC, Eddie?
I'll say 5,000 BC.
5,000 BC? Any idea when the wheel was invented, approximately?
499,000 BC.
When we use the word wheel and inventions, people usually think of the actual wheel and axle mechanism. So, of course, there may have been centuries or millennium of simple rollers that slowly developed in that direction, but the actual machine, axle and wheel machine mechanism, starts to appear in art about 6,500 BC.
1776.
They find, you know, artistic depictions of wagons and toy wagons and things like that around 6,500 BC. How about the domestication of fire? Of course, fire is not something to be invented. It exists in nature like water and air. But humans harnessing the power of fire is an important development.
I'll say 20,000 BC.
20,001
BC. 1 BC.
This is a question that you'll see two different answers for.
So I'm right.
Again, what is sometimes called widespread evidence of the domestication of fire starts to appear 50 to 100,000 years ago.
Oh!
Fire pits, remnants of cooked food, things like that. But there is a suggestion, and again, fire occurs in nature, so this is probably like a process, not a precise thing, that as much as 1 or 2 million years ago, our ancestors were benefiting from fire.
Oh, you know,
not that they knew how to necessarily make fire or tame it, but fire occurs in nature.
Are we still
throw a rabbit on it.
Are we still doing Price is Right?
I'm not even sure what we're doing at this point.
As long as Andy Meredith doesn't win, I don't care what we do.
Dr. Andy Meredith.
As long as Mr. Andy Meredith doesn't win, I don't care what we do.
There's an anthropologist from Brazil. This is going to be our last human invention question. His name is Augusto Boal, and he suggested that there is something that he calls the first human invention, but he also adds this. It's the invention that makes all other inventions possible. Not 11.
The lever,
sorry.
the number 11.
The answer is 11, not 12, not 10, but 11.
Lever, okay. If Andy Meredith had a lever, he could move the eddy.
I'll say opposable thumb.
Opposable thumb? Any thoughts, Sean?
I think that's more of an advent than an invention.
The Snuggie.
The Snuggie? How about you, Dr. Meredith?
Oh, I was wrong.
For the lever was your answer.
Yeah.
Okay.
Wait, how about the human brain? Can that count?
No one invented that. It just happened.
Well, it had to come from somewhere.
Not you or a guy like you 50 million years ago.
She
didn't wake up and be like, oh, yeah, I'm going to grow out a thumb now. That's what my family's going to do.
Professor Boal's answer is not the human brain, but it is something related to human psychology.
Oh, yeah.
And that is the human imagination. And he is a little more specific.
I think the lever was closer than what you said because someone fucking imagined that.
Well, imagine the lever. The thing about imagining the lever is... You see a stick or pole, and you imagine, oh, I could jam that under a boulder and seesaw it out of there. So that ability to imagine what to do with the stick to create the lever. And he does use a phrase which I'll love and you'll mock me for. He actually says it's the theatrical imagination.
Well, I mean...
So he doesn't use imagination in a general... Yes, yeah. to see yourself in a fictitious environment actioning the world.
Like looking at a blanket and like punching arms holes.
Correct, yes, that's the theatrical Snuggie. Imagination. There would be no Snuggie without the theatrical imagination.
But the imagination is housed where in the human brain?
You're still wrong.
Indeed, though many animals have brains.
But they don't have Snuggies.
They do have imagination.
All right, you literate students, this is going to be... We're just going to edit that out later anyway, so there's no point in referring to it. The last week of September is designated by the American Library Association Banned Book Week. So I have a few questions related to Banned Book Week and banned books. These are primarily statistics or titles provided by the American Library Association's website. If you'd like to look into some of this yourself. The first thing that you would probably be interested in is, do people still try to ban books?
All the time.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Indeed. Between 1995 and 2008, the American Library Association reports that there are over 7,000 attempts to ban books.
How many of them were successful?
And they do also add that that's only what's been reported to them, so they assume that the actual number is much higher than that. They use two phrases on their website, challenged books and banned books. So this number, 7,000 plus, refers to challenges. The number of successful bans is a small percentage, although I don't have that precise number in front of me, but it's probably like less than 10% as an approximate number. What do you suppose is the number one complaint to a challenge or attempt to ban a book?
Sex or bad language.
Eddie?
I'll say something that goes against religion, like evolution or something that religious people are threatened by.
Science.
All those things are on the list. Dr. Meredith, by saying sex, it has the correct answer. A gold star for you, Dr. Meredith. 44.
No one's getting points.
44% of the complaints were complaints about sexual content, and 24% were complaints about language. So you got 68% of it.
Damn, I wish I came up with that answer.
They do put religious, political, or anti-family concerns into one number. That's about 12% cover those things. No one mentioned violence. Violence is its own category.
This is America. We're fine with violence.
Well, 12%. We're not fine with violence.
Mormons, whatever.
One other thing, if you go to their website, they break down all these different complaints, and there are some interesting things. I don't want to get into every controversy, but I will say over a 20-year period, they had over 1,000 challenges based on books containing occult matter.
Witchcraft!
Harry Potter. And
like
the copycat books.
Reading, period, let alone about this wizard stuff.
I have here, and just the 21st century, so this is the past 10, 12 years, who are the 5 most commonly challenged authors?
J.K. Rowling.
J.K. Rowling, point for Sean.
I got a point, not a star.
Oh, Salman Rushdie, the Satanic Verses guy?
Not in the top 5.
The guy...
Again, if you go to the website, they have a list of many more.
The Bible. So Jesus.
They do have a separate category on their website that documents challenges to classic books.
Dan Brown?
No, not in the top 5.
Really?
Neither of them?
Nope. J.K. Rowling's the only one you got so far. There is only one classic, who would be considered a classic author on this list of 5.
Jane Austen?
No.
Can you give us a clue?
I thought that was a clue.
Whoever wrote Chicken Noodle Soup for the Soul?
No, but I got something that you'll like in a minute that's related to that.
Okay.
I will give you a clue. This classic author is challenged because of his continuous use of the N-word.
Whoever wrote Huck Finn?
Which is?
It's been a while.
Come on. Only the most famous writer of the 19th century in America.
J.K. Rowling, Jesus.
J.K. Rowling, Jesus. I think J
Mark
stands
Twain.
For Jesus. Jesus K. Rowling.
Yeah, Mark Twain.
Correct.
My mom would shoot me if I didn't know. She's an English teacher.
Oh. Well, you've taught your son well. 3 more, any guesses? At least 2 of these, I think you know. You probably know all 3, but 2 of them are very popular writers. One of them may be sitting at the table with us right now, or his doppelganger.
Stephen King.
Stephen King is in the top 5 most challenged authors of the 21st century.
So how many points do I get?
Shouting out to your mother and your doppelganger in the same sentence. That's great.
Neither of them are going to the...
Judy Blume and Toni Morrison are the other 2. And Judy Blume undoubtedly because Are You There, God, It's Me, Margaret, which is for young readers and makes them question their religious beliefs.
I thought it was about girls getting their periods.
It is about that as well.
Oh, okay.
Yes, but how do you know?
Books only have one theme. This is America.
Now, I did want to say, here's their last banned book question. In 2012, the number 1, and this is listed as banned book, so this is something that has been removed from libraries or school curriculums or that sort of thing. The number 1 banned book in America. Any guesses?
The dictionary.
If anybody, that's an interesting guess, but no.
It's a textbook, like a science book in Texas.
Huckleberry Finn. Dictionary is the kind of book you don't have to ban. It's just going to die on its own.
They did try banning dictionaries in Texas because they contained profanity.
Sure.
I kid you not.
Sure. Information about sex. The word atheist is in the dictionary.
Exactly.
I will give you the clue that it is a children's book.
Go the fuck to sleep.
Oh, Chronicles of Narnia.
The correct answer is, put on your seatbelts, put on your crash helmets, you are going to just, heads will explode. In 2012, the number 1 banned book in America, Captain Underpants.
What?
By Dave Pilkey.
Wow. Like the first one, not the like 14 other
ones. Well, it says the series.
Oh, really?
The series, yep. Offensive language that's unsuitable for its age group is the reason given
it
for banning
it. Underpants.
Yes.
I used to love those.
Of course you did. Everybody
and
loved that.
Look at what you're a dirtbag comedian. Look at you.
That was like a giant
He is a well-dressed comedian. In fact, I'm going to give you 5 self-esteem points to make up for Andy harassing you.
I'm not
All right. Well, that is the end of today's class. I will take a moment and calculate the final grades to determine who will be the winner of the coveted classroom prize, the golden banana. Don't tap on the table. Before I calculate the final grades, I'd like to give you all one more chance for extra credit. If you have any other comments, questions, things you'd like to say to try to improve your grade or make yourself look smart, this is your last chance. Dr. Meredith.
I was going to tell you all about which breed of African swallow was the fastest, but I've forgotten. I researched it special for this day, and I forgot.
You get exactly 0 bonus points for that comment.
Yes. Keep the trend going.
Eddie the Educator Warner, educate us.
Yes, ooh. I would like to share. Thank you, Dr. Meredith. I would like to share that dogs were domesticated from wolves 15,000 B.C.
That sounded a lot like a guess to me. And I don't have that statistic in front of me, so I won't correct it, although I suspect it's longer ago than that. But I do know this interesting fact related to your suggestion, and that is that all dogs are domesticated from wolves, no matter what the breed, and no other wild canine has yet to be properly domesticated, although some are brought into homes, like foxes, for example, but actually domesticated like dogs are, no other wild canine has yet to be fully domesticated.
Now we have a summer project.
The domestication of foxes will probably be a topic in season 2 of Gold Star Classroom, because it's a very interesting science evolution topic. Sean Sullivan, please say something to elevate this whole endeavor of ours. We need it.
The Price is Right game, the check game, was played for the first time in four years in 2013.
Did you just make that up?
No. No, they haven't played the check game in like years, and they just brought it back for the first time. Drew Carey tweeted about it. I follow Drew Carey on Twitter.
On Twitter.
I would like to point out that Drew Carey is in no way a sponsor of this show.
Oh, no.
Although if one wishes to follow him on Twitter, that could certainly be a personal choice in a free democracy. As of now,
Twitter.
I do not. All right. So having calculated your final grades, taking your extra credit comments into account, the coveted classroom prize of Golden Banana will be awarded to the well-dressed Sean Sullivan. So that just leaves it to me, your host, Dr. Jerry Jaffe, to thank you, students, for coming to class today.
And make a bunch of golden bananas.
Can I give my golden banana to charity?
We could auction it on eBay and put the proceeds towards the charity of your choice.
All right.
All right.
Nambla.
Thank you. All right. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Gold Star Classroom is written and produced by Jerry Jaffe. Our producer and engineer is Stephen Gutierrez. Original music composed and produced by Jeff Gettert. Mr. Gettert is also our assistant producer. All commentary and opinions expressed by guests of Gold Star Classroom are meant for entertainment purposes only. For Gold Star Classroom, I'm Jerry Jaffe.